This is going to be kind of odd for me to be restricted to this little baby area, since I like to walk around. But we'll just kind of see how this goes. All right. Thank you for coming out. We are going to be continuing in a series of about 8 classes on women's role in the church. And I think one of the things I want to just start out with is this whole, why in the world are we doing this? Because this is obviously a very controversial issue in our church. And let me tell you one of the reasons. I mean, I've been teaching for you folks for a long time, probably 40 years now. And so we are a church of people. We are a group of people that like to look at the scriptures and base our findings on what the scriptures say, and base our behavior and our organization, everything on what the scriptures say. So let me just show you something that should make us think just a little bit. There are about 900,000 Protestants worldwide. So think of this big pie that represents all the Protestant believers out there. That's a noisy area, isn't it? Would you ask them to come on in or be quiet?
Okay.
All right. That was ugly, wasn't it? Yes, sir.
I know you're a numbers guy.
I'm a numbers guy.
Is it 900,000 or 900 million?
What did I say, 1,000?
Yeah.
I meant to say 900 million.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Joseph. There's about 900 million Protestants worldwide. Within that group, there are about 2 million churches of Christ. So you got big pie, and within that's a fairly small part of that pie. And then within that very small part of the pie, you have churches of Christ below the Mason-Dixon line and churches of Christ above the Mason-Dixon line. So now there are some above the Mason-Dixon line that were planted by churches below the Mason-Dixon line, so that's a separate little part. But the circle keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, when we see this great circle of people doing things one way, and this tiny circle doing things differently, I think that should make us at least pause. Me as a person who studies the scriptures, I think that should make us at least pause. Maybe we are John the Baptist crying in the wilderness. For the rest of the folks, y'all are doing this all wrong. Or it should make us at least pause and look at the scriptures. So that's one of the things. One of the things I think that causes me to want to do this. The second thing is, we actually have songs that we sing that say God is an unchanging God. That's one of the, God has a lot of characteristics that make him a God that's worthy of being adored. He's a God of great love. He's a God of great forgiveness. He's also an unchanging God. And if he's an unchanging God, one of the things we have to struggle with is this woman here. We got to struggle with Deborah. And what does it say about Deborah in Judges? We studied Judges in our life group, and as it turns out, they changed the slides on me so it doesn't highlight some of the things. But it says Deborah was a prophetess, the wife of Lippidoth. Look at this next phrase. She was leading Israel at that time. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And look at this next phrase. The Israelites came to her to have their disputes settled. And Deborah is held up in the scriptures as a great woman of God. There's not the slightest suggestion that there was something wrong with Deborah. So if we think that God is an unchanging God, we actually have songs where we sing that. And I think that's true. How do we deal with Deborah? They have left a slide out. We have the old, where's Ken? Is Ken here? Ken's not here. There is also, there's a slide. Hey, Blaine, you know how to put a different slide deck in here real quick? On this, do you know how to put a different one in here?
I don't understand what you're asking.
This is pretty important because I don't want to give, I changed this up and they didn't change it.
You'll send it.
You
gotta send it.
I did.
This is what you sent me.
Second time?
You sent us.
I sent a second.
Oh, you didn't send me a second.
Oh, shoot. This is gonna mess up the black and white, isn't it?
Yeah, because we won't be able to see those.
Okay. Well, let's, golly. I think this one doesn't show up. Did the background of this one not show up? Well, because it has a dark background. Well, that's all right. Forget it.
We didn't test it. I just moved it where I thought it would work. We just moved it where I thought it would work.
Okay.
Just changed it.
All right. We'll get the wrong thing. That's all right. We'll work through this. There's a couple of key principles I want us to think about as we go through this. And one of these key principles is the principle of accommodation. This would be the next slide I would have had up here. And this is a quote that Paul has, where Paul says basically, to Jews, I have become Jews. To people under the law, I have become people under the law, even though I'm not under the law. To Gentiles, I've become whatever's Gentile. What he basically is saying there is that Paul looks at the culture that he's operating in, and he adapts the message to that culture. Okay? Now, having said that, Paul does not say whatever the culture is doing is okay, we just adapt to that. Okay? I know a lot of you are thinking, my goodness, if we make this change, it would look what the culture is doing on the basis of what the culture is doing. But we can do anything, right? Except Paul would not take that position. There are things that the scriptures are very clear about. Don't do this. And there are no scriptures out there that even hint that this is all right. For example, same-sex marriage. Okay? We might look around and say, well, our society's adopting the same-sex marriage. Maybe the church should do that too. But the problem is, we do not see anything in the scriptures that says anything other than this is a man married to a woman. We don't see any scriptures out there that even hint that this is okay. We see scriptures, our society now is taking the position that being a practicing homosexual is okay. All right, well, our church is not going to adapt that place because we see all kinds of scriptures that say this is not okay. And we don't have a single solitary scripture out there that says this is real, that even hints that this kind of behavior is okay. Now, I made the difference between being a homosexual and being a practicing homosexual. Okay, those are two different things. Okay, so Paul would not say we adapt to whatever society has to say, but he does say we look at the culture around us and we make adjustments on the basis of that. We adjust our message on the basis of that. So Ronnie last week said something about the why. Okay? The why is really important in some of these passages. And so what we have here is we have two passages that say one thing, and we have a whole bunch of other passages suggesting that this is not a problem. And so one of the things we have to do as a church is to grapple with that, because the main reason that Paul had this principle of accommodation in there was because it was helping the mission of the church. The mission of the church is to seek and save the lost. And if we can make some adjustments to culture that will help us seek and save the lost, that is not against the scriptures, it's not something clearly said against the scriptures, that it's not even hinted that it's okay, then we do that. And I think that's what Paul is probably doing in some of these cases. So what he says here, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I did not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent. For Adam was formed first and then Eve. Adam was not the one deceived. It was a woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing as they continue in faith, love, and holiness. And so there's a very similar passage in Corinthians. And Chuck is going to talk about this next week. He actually has a handout over here for you to take with you next week. And so, as I've mentioned this to you before when I've taught this class before, this is the way I kind of think about this. When I got up this morning, I took a multivitamin. I take a multivitamin every single morning because I think that's what's best for my health. Now, about twice a year, I get a sinus infection. And so on those particular days, for about 10 days, I'll take an antibiotic because something has changed, something is different that I had to fix. And so what we have to decide as a church is, are these two verses about women being silent not having authority, not being able to teach, are these multi-gods that go across all cultures at all times? Or are these antibiotics that were put in place at a particular point in time because of a particular problem that existed in these two churches? That's what we have, to me, that's what we have to decide. And there's kind of two different views on this position, and I could have said group A and group B, and so there's nothing personative about either one of these phrases. One is the traditional view of these, and the second is the non-traditional view. And the traditional view believes that these two commands we're going to talk about are culturally transcendent. They go across all cultures at all times, and they apply at all times across all cultures. And so the non-traditional view, on the other hand, says these commands are antibiotics. They were prescribed for a specific problem that existed in Ephesus and Corinth. And they are required because of culturally specific problems of that day, and they apply today only if similar problems exist today. Now, let's look at the pros and cons of each one of these views, with particular emphasis on 1 Timothy. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent. Well, the traditional view is, I believe it says what it says. Women should learn in quietness and full submission. Women should not be allowed to teach, and teaching by its very nature being authoritative. Why would the traditional folks believe that, or people who believe take this position? And part of it is what follows after that in verses 13 and 14. For Adam was formed first, and then Eve. And so the idea here is that the priority of man in creation is a precedent for the true order of the sexes, especially in marriage and in public worship. In matters of salvation and who is loved by God, there is neither slave nor free, male, it should be male and female, by the way, Jew nor Greek, when it matters of salvation. But when it comes to this particular issue, they say because of the order of creation, there is precedent for there being this order in public worship. And then it says that Adam was not the one deceived, it was a woman who was deceived and became a sinner. There are actually, not very many, but there are actually some traditionalists who believe that women have a greater likelihood of being led astray, so certainly should not be allowed to teach. I think that's a fairly small group, but some group of people. And so I think South Baton Rouge Church of Christ has been based on the traditional way of thinking. Women are not allowed to teach men here. They are not allowed to wait on the Lord's Supper. They do not lead prayers in assembly or Sunday school. They do not read scriptures in public assembly. And I don't believe a woman heads up any major committee that contains men. So we've kind of adopted the traditional way of understanding these passages. Now, there are some difficulties for us with this that we just have to look at in the face. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent. Now, why have we let women sing? Why have we chosen to let women make comments in this class? Maybe we're missing up on that. But we do allow that to happen. Now, part of the answer to this is that the word silent here in the Greek, and it's important for us to kind of focus in on this notion, what does it say in the Greek, as you'll see in just a moment. Silent here in 1 Timothy does not mean absolute silence. It is a Greek word, hesychia, which means stillness, a desistance from bustle, whatever that means. There, a guy who came through here and preached before for us, Lindsay Garvin, said it means to have a quiet spirit. It doesn't mean absolute silence. However, the problem, as Chuck will point out next week, is that when it comes to 1 Corinthians 14, as in all the congregations of the saints, women should remain silent in the church. And this is right in the middle of a whole section of 1 Corinthians that deal with public worship. Okay? And it says silent. And that word means silent. Okay? So, what do we do here? If we say it says what it says, what do we do with this? how do we harmonize other passages on the very active role of women in the first century church? I'm going to very quickly hit some of these. They were covered by Ronnie and some others earlier on, but when Paul writes to Corinth, in that whole section that Chuck's going to talk about next week, about order in the worship service, this is what he says. I praise you for remembering me and everything and for holding to the teaching just as I passed them on to you. Now I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is man, the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. Every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is just as though her head were unshaven. So right here in the middle of this description of what's going on in the public worship, we have women praying and prophesying. Now, there was a problem in this particular, there's a why, as Ronnie talked about before, about why he made this particular comment about uncovered heads, okay? And I'll let Chuck talk about that next week. But there was a why because of that, but behind that. But here we have women who are praying and prophesying. Garman said, well, they're exercising this outside the assembly, but this is right smack dab in the middle of descriptions of what is going on in a public worship. So, how do we harmonize the other passages with the very active role of women in the first century church? I think it was Ronnie who talked about this last week. In Acts 21, we continued our voyage from Tyre and landed at Ptolemais, where we greeted the brothers and stayed with them for a day. Leaving the next day, we reached Caesarea and stayed at the house of Philip, the evangelist, one of the seven. He had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. Maybe they weren't prophesying in assembly, but they did prophesy. In Luke 2, here's Anna there in the temple. There was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was very old. She had lived with her husband 7 years after her marriage and then was a widow until she was 84. She never left the temple, but worshiped night and day, fasting and praying. Maybe she was doing silent prayer. Coming up to them at that very moment, she gave thanks to God and spoke about the child to all who were looking forward to the redemption of the Jerusalem. Now, there's a lot of explanations for what might be going on here. On the cons, we have Joel. I will pour out my spirit on all the people, your sons and daughters. He's prophesying about the coming of the Messiah. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old man will dream dreams. Your young men will see visions. And then here we have Deborah. Here again, held court. She was leading these people. She was acting particularly picked out and chosen as a judge to redeem the people from the situation that they were in. Any reference in the New Testament to women being teachers that we have to struggle with? Here we have this situation of Priscilla and Aquila. You know the story of Apollos. A Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures. He had been instructed in the ways of the Lord. And he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue, and then Priscilla and Aquila heard them, and they invited him to their house and explained to him the way of God more adequately. As I think Ronnie pointed out earlier, Priscilla was the woman. In this particular society, mentioning the woman first is pretty strong evidence she was very actively involved in teaching Apollos. A visitor, and not, by the way, Apollos was not her husband. A visitor who was sitting behind me last week said, "Yeah, but they weren't in church." Well, actually, in Romans, this is what it says about Priscilla and Aquila. My fellow workers, by the way, as fellow workers applies to both of them, what does that phrase mean? What do we do with that phrase? They were fellow workers. In Jesus Christ. They risked their lives for me. Not only I, but all the churches of the Gentiles are grateful to them. Greet also the church that meets at their house. This is where they had church. They didn't have buildings like we had. They met at each other's house. So here's at least one level of suggestion that a woman was involved in teaching. Non-traditionalists would say this is evidence of a woman teaching the assembly. Then we have Euodia and Syntyche. Again, in Philippians, I plead with Euodia, and I plead with Syntyche to agree with each other in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, loyal yokemen, help these women who have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers, whose names are in the book of life. Now, in the original handout that I gave, these things that are underlined are in red. What are those things that are underlined mean? Okay. That's something we have to struggle with. So to sum up, the traditionalist view says, it says what it says. These are vitamins to be taken every day. It's culturally transcendent, and this is what we need to do. But what about the evidence? I'll call this fact, it's some evidence that women prayed in the assembly, prophesied in the assembly, may have taught in the assembly, and I put question marks here, may have been deaconesses. Okay. You're the founding fathers of our group. Campbell and Barton Stone were in churches where women served as deacons, by the way. Just so you kind of know that. They were above the Mason-Dixon line. They're in Pennsylvania. So, we kind of, if we're going to be true to the word, if we are word people, we can't pick and choose here. And so, I'm going to basically skip this one here. Now, let's talk about the non-traditionalist view. And they would argue that the prescriptions in 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Corinthians 14 are antibiotics prescribed for a particular problem in churches in Ephesus and Corinth. And so, we would use this silence and no teaching only if we have the same problems here today. So there's kind of three, and I'm only going to talk about two of principles behind this. One is this principle of accommodation that I mentioned to you before. And this is the verse out of 1 Corinthians 9, 19-23. Even though I'm a free, belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. The Jews become like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law become like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that all possible means I might save some. That's kind of the key for us, to me. It's great to come here and to feel comfortable and to feel like I've escaped from the world. I've come here with my group of people and I feel comfortable. We understand the purpose of the church is not to make us feel comfortable. The purpose of the church is to seek and save the lost. That's our mission. And what Paul is saying here is I look at culture out there and I adapt what I do to what's going on in the culture. That's not an unlimited adaption. He's not going to say abortion is okay. It's okay in New York after a woman has fully had gone through the full term of 9 months and had a baby. We put the baby on the table here and then decide whether or not the baby should live or not. And so the city of New York lights up their buildings in pink because of this wonderful new law. There's not a single solitary scripture that even hints that that's okay. We have a bunch of them that say it's not okay. There's not a single solitary one. Paul is not going to adapt to that. But if there are things out there that he can adapt to help achieve the mission of the church, he's going to do that. So I know a lot of times we say, we're not letting culture in work its way into the church, but Paul is saying precisely the opposite of that. The most key and most important thing is the mission. And if I can make some changes to achieve that mission, then I will do that. So he was more concerned with the missionary strategy than social progress or social issues. And so this was a government that was hostile to groups when women played. That could be what was going on here. He was trying to spread the word in a world where the patriarchal dominance was the norm. That's what their culture was like. He still believed and taught equity in Christ. There's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. You're all one in Christ. But in this particular environment, apparently, that he was in, maybe, women's roles were subordinated to the higher role of reaching the law. If you looked out there, this is a patriarchal society. This is a society, a culture in which if you have women running things, this could be bad. That's one possibility out there. Now, and I think this is really critical here in our thinking. I talked about the principle of accommodation. There's one other very important principle. And that's the principle of subordination. We talked about this when we studied Romans. We talked about this when we studied 1 and 2 Timothy. God does not like anarchy. God likes there to be order. He likes there to be order in society. He likes there to be order in church. He likes there to be order in the home. And so in order to do that, he puts some people in a position where other people are subordinate to them. They're submissive to this person up here. But if you look through the scriptures, he also does something else to make sure that things don't get out of hand. Every single time, he says, you people in the church, submit yourself to your elders. Then he says, elders, do not lord it over your people. He says to husbands, wives, submit yourself to your husbands. And then he has 9 verses in which he says, men, do not misuse this position. You are to love your wife like Christ loved the church. You are to love your wife as if she is part of your own body. Then he says, children, submit yourself to your parents. And then he says, fathers, don't exasperate your children. There is a principle here that God wants order, but he doesn't want this person up here to act like an autocrat. Okay, to tell these, you're going to do what I tell you to do, by the way, and that's the way it's going to be. All the way through the scriptures, we see this principle about subordination. Now, it's not uncompromising. So, watch this. I think it's very important because I believe it says what it says. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. Now, it's kind of interesting that this phrase right here that's underlined that says to have authority over is one word in the Greek, and that's this word authetian. Now, this is the only time this word is used in the entire New Testament. The usual Greek word when he talks about authority is this word exousia. Word exousia has no negative content to it at all. There's nothing bad. This person is in authority over this person. There's no negative content to that word at all. It's kind of interesting that he used, and by the way, we don't have a whole lot of cases or context in which to establish the precise meaning of that very first word up there, right? But isn't it significant that Paul, of all the things he writes, where he uses the word authority, always uses this word here, exousia, he picked out this other word. Why did he pick out that word instead of just using exousia? Okay, well, here's what you'll do. Apparently, this is a very strong word which means to dominate or to run over. Now, what I did is I looked at a bunch of different sources for the definition of this word, this phrase. Strong's Greek Dictionary says dominance. Vine's Expository Dictionary says to dominate. Thayer's Greek English Lexicon says an absolute master to exercise dominion over. And the Complete Word Study Dictionary says to exercise authority or power over as an autocrat or to dominate. Now, so what is, there are overtones behind this word of violence and power. I don't think he's saying it. We say it says what it says, and I think it does say what it says in the Greek. He did not use the word exousia. He didn't say that women can't have authority over men, can't be put in a position of authority over men. He says women can't be put in a position of authority over a man and misuse it any more than elders can, any more than husbands can, any more than fathers can. You cannot use your authority in that way. Women should not exercise authority in a negative, domineering, autocratic, and harmful way. And not allow them to behave like feminazis, if you like that word. Now, traditionally, verse 12 prohibits women from teaching and having authority over men. Non-traditionists would say no. It prohibits women from teaching in a domineering way, in an autocratic way. And so, why would he have to choose this word when he's writing to the church in Ephesus? Remember, Timothy is in Ephesus. Well, what is the main religion in Ephesus? The main religion in Ephesus, the biggest temple, the most famous shrine, was a female-only cult. If you were Greek, you refer to this as the Temple of Artemis. If you are a Roman, you refer to it to the temple as Diana. And this, all the priests in this temple were women. And they ruled the show, and they kept men in their place. And so, with this background, what could Paul be saying here? The old ways of organizing male and female roles need to be rethought now. I did not want the church to think that this is a new system where women could come in and be leading and keeping men in line, just like the priestess in the Temple of Artemis. You had a particular cultural issue out here that Paul had to deal with. Women should have the right to study like men, but not in order to have bossy leadership roles like under Artemis. As Ronnie said, what's the why? Well, there's one possible why for that. And so the problem of deliberately provocative, sexually provocative dress, which would be what a priestess in Artemis would do, deliberately provocative dress. So Paul would say that women should not dress in a particular way with braids and gold and stuff like the priestess of Artemis did. You're not to dress like that, because of this particular cultural situation out there. There was a need to accommodate governments at a time when the patriarchal attitudes of that day, and there was a problem of the abuse of the new freedom in Christ by women at the time. So, holy cow, I was hoping I would end up without any questions. So I've been teaching this for a long time, but that's kind of where I've come to on this. And I know this is tricky, and I know it's dicey, and I know we're people of the Word. We want to study the Word and do what the Word says. And opposition is we can do what the Word says, especially what it says in the Greek. I think we could do that and be okay. Yeah, Doug?
I think there are some things that are not been mentioned in general, not just with you, but for example, Deborah was never allowed to be a priest. And, the women, he says the women are not allowed to speak or teach in any of the churches. So it's not strictly for that specific church, it's all churches. And I think those are two important points that need to be considered.
For those who are listening in other rooms, the question was about Deborah not being a priestess, and the other was that when I did not in 1 Timothy that you said women are not to speak in all the churches.
Right.
I think you said that.
I think that's in 1 Corinthians. I'm not sure, but where he says.
Well, let's go back to 1 Corinthians. See if I can find 1 Corinthians real quick. I passed it.
And also the fact where Abraham, where Sarah is mentioned as being under Abraham almost as though she worshipped him, although I'm not suggesting that women should worship their husbands, but it was very much as a subordinate relationship in that scripture. I think it's in 1 or 2 Peter.
I want to see the 1 Corinthians. All right. That's not it either. Here we go. In the church, it doesn't say all.
It's
I don't think.
All the congregations. Yeah,
silent in the churches.
In all the congregations of the saints, all the churches. Yeah. Well, the other translations say churches instead of congregations, but that's. Mm-hmm.
My response to that was, I don't know if he's talking about all the churches. Remember, they're house churches, right? Kind of like we have life group. We have life groups, but we have a lot of churches that are meeting in life groups tonight. If I were a non-traditionalist, I would argue that that's all the churches in Corinth. It's a big city. Okay. I mean, that's what I would argue. But then I've got this tricky thing, Doug, I've got to deal with I've got to deal with all these other positions. Now, in the case of Deborah, there's no question that Deborah had authority over people, right? Is there any question? She was leading them. The men even asked her to lead them into battle, right? She settled disputes among all the Israelites. She had a lot of things that she was doing, and we have to grapple with that as traditionalists.
Right, I understand, but I'm just saying I see a difference between, you know, can a woman be the head of a country? Yes, I mean, I see that in Deborah. Can a woman speak in the church? I don't see that in the scriptures.
Okay. All right. Yeah, David.
Yeah. Also, when it comes to Deborah, she's one blip amongst the many men that are in there, and to grab that one example and say, look, see, we have an example of something, you know, therefore it must be okay, we can ignore the rest because we have to deal with this little blip that's mm-hmm. out there. I say no to that line of reasoning. The Bible also says that men, to be an elder or a deacon, you must also be married. Well, there are examples of people in the Bible who were single, who were great leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean we can then do away with that and say, well, look, if you're not married, it's okay, you can still be an elder or a deacon?
Mm-hmm.
The same thing goes with a new convert. I mean, Paul was a new convert. Does that mean Paul could have been an elder or a deacon? Actually, no, he can't. And it really doesn't matter if you say, I have the gift of leadership. You may very well have the gift of leadership, but mm-hmm. that does not mean can ignore the scriptures for the sake of wanting to try to find some kind of example, some blip in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible, I mean, all the apostles were male. All the deacons that were mentioned that were picked, the servants, like mm-hmm. the ones that were picked to serve the tables, they were males. It goes on and on and on about male, male, male. There's nothing wrong with a female being a leader, but when you're trying desperately to find some way to justify what you're believing, that's nothing more than just contriving something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying desperately to grasp at straws because I want this to be this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, so your argument is you don't take one example of Deborah as being, if I understand what you're saying, and base your argument on that. If I were a non-traditionalist, I would say you're taking two verses out of all the verses in the Bible and basing your position on that. We're people of the Word. I understand we're people of the Word. But remember the very first point. Doesn't it make you kind of wonder, just a little bit, when you have the big pie and there's a little teeny part of that big pie that thinks differently than all the big pie? Is there something wrong? Is there something that wrong with all these people? To me, that gives me pause. Larry?
So, no, Lord, in fact, it's just the opposite. We're taught that the gate that we're supposed to go through is very, very narrow.
Yep.
And the susceptibility of us as Christians to go away from the gate that we're directed is just scary to me. And so, no, that principle doesn't scare me at all as a believer. I want to aim for that narrow gate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be distracted. Why would I want to take a chance that I would go in a different direction and maybe run into a barbed wire fence rather than...
Well, let me respond to why you might want to take a chance, okay? Our position, go back to the principle of accommodation. Our principle may have been okay in the 50s when women mainly took care of homes. But now we have a culture in which women are women are very much involved in the economy. They're in all kinds of leadership roles, all kinds of positions out there of authority, etc. And they're looking at the South Baton Rouge Church of Christ, and they walk in the door. We had somebody do this, walk in the door, and came to our life groups, came to our sermons, our teaching, came to our church. And then one day, somebody stood up and said, you're limited in what you can teach kids. You can't be a deaconess. You can't take any kind of leadership role. And she walked, she didn't walk. She ran out of that building crying. So My suggestion to you to think about is that as a principle of accommodation, are we, when we have a culture now where women are very much involved in society and all different kinds of roles, to do that. Now, the narrow gate, let me point out about the narrow gate. There are 4 billion people in the world. The pie, the total pie is huge. So if I were on the other side, if I were non-traditionalist, I would say the 900 million is a tiny part of that pie. And we are an infinitesimal part of that part of the pie. I mean, I'm talking about Protestants.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So you have this big pie that represents the world population is 4 billion. A really tiny part of that pie is 900 million Protestants. Now, I'm just suggesting to you that as a person who's taught in college and all this stuff, which doesn't matter, but to me that makes me stop and wonder. That just makes me pause and say, wait a minute. Is it really possible that we're John the Baptist in the desert? All these other people are wrong. That just makes me pause. Yeah, Joe?
I'm not real sure how to interpret this. When you talk about it says what it says, I think that we are being disingenuous to stick to this and says women keep silent. And in that same passage, 5 verses later, it says,
yeah,
desire earnestly to prophesy and do not forbid to speak in tongues.
Yeah. Well, there's something else even. That's
says
right.
What it says.
Yeah. Well, actually, two verses later, it says, women, you will be saved through childbearing. Do we believe it says what it says? If so, that sounds like heresy to me. I thought people were only saved one way. That's through the blood of Christ. Number two, does that mean any of you ladies that are not married had better get pregnant? We believe it says what it says, then we've got to struggle with this because it's right in that same set of passages. That's tough for us to deal with. Thank you for your questions and thank you for your attention.
Quick announcement, as you go out that door or this door, there's a handout and it's an overview of 1 Corinthians. And in an odd way, this is not what we will talk about next week.
It is strange.
Because we're going to talk almost only about 1 Corinthians 11 and 14, whereas this is big picture of 1 Corinthians overview. Other stuff will be discussed next week, but I recommend everybody read this. So that door and this one.